For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, so yeah, we're going to continue on in our study of the letter of 1 John written by the Apostle John. John was really old when he wrote this. I think of like kind of this old pastor, you know, by candlelight, just kind of writing thoughts to the group that he was addressing. We don't know exactly where these Christians were. Cluster of churches somewhere in Asia Minor. And they'd been through hell. These churches had been rocked by a tremendous division. People that were misrepresenting Jesus came into these communities teaching things that were just wrong. And they won a following and actually led a group of people out of these communities. So there was a schism, and a large number of people, along with these false teachers, left. You know, if you've ever been in a situation like that, like the remaining people in these communities who stayed faithful to John's teaching, when you see a lot of people leave, a part of you is going, well, I wonder if they have it right and we have it wrong. You know, it's unsettling. And so John, in this letter, he's trying to reassure them that they're on the right track. One thing he reminds them is that the apostles' message, John and his companions, their message about Jesus is correct. The opening of the letter, you know, we're telling you what we heard with our own ears, what we saw with our own eyes and our hands handled. We were with Jesus. This is what he said. That's a big emphasis in this book. Another big emphasis is that when we sin, and every Christian does, that we have an advocate with the Father. You know, you look at a Christian, they're not unique because they're sinless. They're just forgiven, right? A Christian has come to God at some point aware of the burden of our sin and just that we do things that offend God, and we've turned to Jesus as our advocate. He stands in our place and argues on our behalf. He tells the Father, look, my blood, which I shed on the cross when I died for the sins of the world, that blood covers your sin, my sin. He's our advocate because he was punished in our place. And the author here wants these Christians to know, and I'm sure he would want you to know, that they can be assured that they're forgiven because they've turned to God and asked for his forgiveness. If you haven't done that, I would totally urge you to do that, to rely on Jesus to be your advocate. Another thing he's emphasizing is that the mark of a true Christian is love. Love for other people. A transformed life. This is how we identify, you know, God at work in the life of a believer. And so these are huge things. You could see how a loving pastor who cared about his flock would want his people to know these things. But here's another thing. It might strike you as odd that he wants them to know. And this was an emphasis that came out last week when Gary taught. He wants them to know that they've overcome the evil one. All right, now this phrase here, the evil one, that's a reference to Satan. And what he's reminding his audience of is that behind the visible battle between the apostles and these false teachers over the truth about God, there is an unseen battle going on, a backdrop, a battle between Satan, who is a fallen angel, who's hostile to God, an unseen battle between Satan and his demons and God himself, a struggle for the truth, and that struggle has spilled out into their church through the false teachers who are animated by Satan and his demons as they try to mislead this church. He feels like this is crucial for his audience to understand, and I think it's crucial for us as well. Now, I realize, you know, some folks are like, okay, that's cool. Evil demons running around deceiving people and telling them lies. Really? You know, for a lot of us, we'd probably put Satan right up there with the Easter Bunny or like a leprechaun or something like that. Just some silly guy with a pitchfork running around trying to scare people that doesn't really exist. Well, how can I respond? Let me give you a couple things to think about. First, cover to cover, start to finish. The Bible repeatedly talks about the existence of Satan and demons. If you give the Bible a fair reading, you can't deny that it asserts that these evil beings exist. Secondly, it depicts these beings as being bent on keeping people in the dark about God, that's what they're all about. They do not want you to have accurate knowledge of God. That's how they want to destroy you. And, you know, this idea that there's personal evil in the world, that it's not just humans doing wicked things, but humans animated by beings that we can't see, energizing us to hurt each other and hurt ourselves because they hate us and they hate God. Is that all that fantastic? I've been to Cambodia. I got to tour the country. One thing I saw there was the killing fields. And I saw the tree where they were smashing babies' heads over and over again and killing them systematically. I saw Tuol Sleng, the torture prison, where they did unspeakable things to their political enemies. And, you know, you go to a place like that, and it's just the idea that there's a malevolence in the world energizing people to do this kind of thing doesn't seem that preposterous. You know, I work with kids from broken backgrounds, and they tell me about some of the trauma and just the evil that they've been subject to growing up. And again, it's not implausible. Maybe you could ponder this. I think in the last Gallup poll, 91% of Americans accept that there's a spiritual being called God out there. That's what most people think. If that's the case, how unlikely is it that there are other spiritual beings, evil beings, that are hostile to God as well? I don't think this is quite as crazy as you would think. And it's important that we absorb this teaching before we go any further. This is the assertion about Satan and his impact on the world. 2 Corinthians 4, it says, even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So he mentions this figure, the God of the world, the God of this world, this cosmos. Who is that? Well, he's talking about Satan. He's not talking about the creator God. He's talking about a being that influences the way we live. He says this being, Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbelieving. That's what he does. That's what he's skilled at. The implications of this are profound. This means that you sitting here, if you don't know Christ, have been kept from the truth by these evil beings, kept in the dark, kept from knowing a good God that loves you deeply and has gone to great lengths to reach you. That there is a thought out plan for keeping you in the dark, and it's effective. It's effective in blinding the minds of people that don't know the Lord. That's the biblical picture. Is it crazy talk? Well, I don't want you to think I'm talking about, you know, something like The Exorcist. I think those things happen very rarely. You know, you're not probably going to run into a Linda Blair rotating her head 360 degrees and vomiting on you like you'd see in that movie. But you are running into this thing the Bible calls the cosmos. Every hour of every day until you die, you are going to be affected by this. And this is what these three verses in 1 John 2 address. So I want to get into that. I want to talk about what it is. What is this thing, the cosmos, that Satan uses to deceive people? What are the components of the cosmos? And why should we reject it? And as I go through that last bullet, we'll talk a little bit about how we actually go about decisively rejecting the cosmos as a Christian. Okay, what is it? Let's look at the passage. He says, and starting in verse 15, don't love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, it's not from the Father, but it's from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. So the main command in the paragraph is very clear. Do not love the world. Pretty easy to understand. The word for world here is based on the Greek word cosmos. And this is one of those words that has a range of meaning. Some passages it refers to human beings that God loves. God so loved the cosmos, the race of humans, that he gave his only begotten son, you know, so that we wouldn't perish. Other passages that can actually refer to, you know, the physical earth. This is the cosmos, this spinning ball of rock that we're on, that God made. And obviously, that is not the way he's using the cosmos here. That's not the meaning. Neither meaning works in this passage. There is a third way that the word cosmos is used, not just in 1 John, but in other parts of the Bible. And all the evidence for what it means is right in this text. Let's just look a little closer. He says, all that is in the cosmos, in the world, basically has component parts. He says, it's the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. What are those? Well, we'll get into it in more detail, but these are values. These are things that people care about, that drive their actions. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. This is a fabric or a system of values put before humanity with one purpose: to take your eyes off of God and onto anything else, to distract you from knowing what's true about God. So let's define the cosmos as a system of values authored by Satan and designed to keep people away from God. That's what it is. Now, you know, we're all in different groups of people in different settings. Every group has its values. I was in a group once called the Jungle Man Club. It's a cool group. I hear some laughing. The Jungle Man Club, I was one of the founding members. Me and my buddies, when I was 11 years old, we started the Jungle Man Club. And what you did was you went crashing through a creek. There was a creek near my grandparents' house, and we would go out on these expeditions. And we kind of had a code of conduct, kind of a rule of life as jungle men. The first rule was, don't talk about the Jungle Man Club. No, that's actually not what it was. There were two simple rules. The first rule was always take the hard way. Okay, which means if there's a deep part of the creek, go through it. If it's mucky and stagnant and disgusting, go through it. You always go through the hardest part of the creek. Second rule was kill every living thing that you encounter. Okay? So, crawdads, tadpoles, minnows, whatever we came across, it was bad. I had to finally leave it last year because it was so out of control. Nah, it's been a while, but anyhow, you know how it is. You get people together, they have their thing. Watch the movie Office Space, right? There's corporate culture. What's the value? Bureaucracy, right? Fill out your TPC report. Well, the world we live in is the same way. It has values. And I'll tell you, it's not love that makes the world go round. It's those values put before us, arranged. That's what the word cosmos means. That's where we get cosmetic from. It's an arrangement meant to be attractive, to seduce us and draw our attention away from God. Okay, here's something to think about. Where is it that we're going to really encounter the world? Well, it's going to be everywhere you go. the world is in sport. These values are clearly in sports. They're in educational institutions. They're in our world's militaries. In our music. We see values, some of these values in the movie theaters. And the world is right here in the church. Everywhere you go. And I'm not saying all of these institutions and organizations are just through and through satanic. I'm just saying that the evil one has made his presence known through this value system everywhere you go. It's the air we breathe. One theologian says the world is an atmosphere. It's a mood. It's nearly as hard for a sinner to recognize the world's temptations as it is for a fish to discover impurities in the water. There's a sense and a feeling that things are not right, but just what it is eludes analysis. That's right. That's a good description. I was sealing my basement wall a while back, you know, putting on this basement sealer. And I probably was down there for 2 or 3 hours, and I came up to my kitchen to get a drink, and I was like, holy crap, I'm high as a kite. And, you know, it's one of those things I didn't notice when I was painting the wall, but you don't notice. It's gradual, right? It's like a fine dust, these values. And they settle down on you. And they're everywhere you go, and they start to shape what you care about. Go look at Ephesians 2:2 at some point. Paul says that Satan is the prince of the power of the atmosphere, he says. The wind that is at work in the sons of disobedience. That's his language. This is so clear. He's saying there's this climate, what the Germans would call like a zeitgeist, that energizes people for evil and keeps their focus away from God. Now maybe that's a little more plausible, don't you think? I think that's a way more plausible concept of how the evil one would work. Let's look a little more closely at these components. The lust of the flesh. Lust here is, it's an inordinate, unsatisfiable, insatiable desire, a lust. Here it's a lust for physical pleasure. Easiest summary word would be hedonism. Now, this is a bowl of golden grams right here. This is the best cold cereal human beings have ever invented. I love this cereal so much. No joke. People give me boxes of this for Christmas. Here you go. If I start eating golden grams, it's just hard to tell when I'm going to stop. I mean, I put down a whole box in the course of a couple hours. And this is the way it is with the lust of the flesh. It's you don't know how to stop. It takes legitimate things like hunger and pushes them so that we're so into gorging ourselves, so into feasting, that we go way beyond satisfying our need and do things that hurt ourselves or maybe even hurt other people. It takes a legitimate desire like having sex with somebody. And it says it must be satisfied now at all costs, regardless of the consequences. The lust of the flesh is something that deeply resonates with us, like so many of these values do. And this is part of what makes it difficult, is the world and these values, they're not just out there. They're not just being propagated by the evil one. But they're in here, too. And when we're exposed to these values, they deeply resonate. You ever lifted open the lid of a grand piano and held down the sustain pedal and sung a note? You ever done that before? What happens? It reverberates. The string that matches your note will sing right back to you. And in a similar, very similar way, Satan lifts our lid, shouts his values in through this cosmos, and it deeply resonates with us. It stirs a part of us, a part we know deep down is wrong, and it energizes us for action. That's how it works. It's another value, the lust of the eyes. This is an inordinate desire to obtain what we see. I run in Clintonville a lot just because I like Clintonville. And one of my favorite runs is to go up Walhalla. And a big reason why I like to run up Walhalla is I like to look at those houses. The landscaping, just, they're all really unique because of the terrain. Now, if you live on Wall, maybe somebody here lives there. I'm not going to stalk you. I just like your house. That's all. That's all I'm saying. Now, these houses, I can go home and go, I think I'm going to check out what would it really cost to live there? You get the MLS listing and all that stuff. Or you think about other things that capture our attention, like this is a Honda Fit right here. This is kind of a strange angle, but just look at the way those seats lay down. Isn't that cool? And the way that front passenger seat just kind of lays flat. Just think of what you could put in there. This is such a thoughtfully well-crafted piece of machinery. I'm an empty nester. This is a good fit for me. Oh, it's a Fit. Right, the Honda Fit. So I look at this, and you know how it is when you get excited? I mean, if you've been house hunting, how consuming can that be? It's all consuming. And it's not like, Honda Fits are from the pit of hell. That's not it. It's that all this buying and consuming and comparing and contrasting, that takes mental bandwidth. Your time and thoughts go to owning, storing, polishing, and maintaining stuff. A lot. Stuff you don't need. And you're standing in the grocery store going, should I get the exfoliating sea marine body wash? Or this strawberry bath gel? What should I do? Well, who cares? What a waste of time. Well, you know who cares? Satan cares. Because every second you spend on inane things like that is one more second that you don't have to devote to, what is it about that nagging feeling that there is a God? And where is this all headed? And what is my life about? And what really matters? What's true? What's all going to come of this? Well, I got to go figure out if I'm going to get low-fat yogurt. I don't have time to think about that. This is the way it is. One author, John White, I've used this quote a lot, but I love it. He says, Satan the deceiver understands his business well. Anyone who can keep you feverishly hunting for the perfect deodorant without letting you realize what an ass you are. What a fool you are is supremely competent. Yeah. Now listen, just think about this, Christians. We are spending too much, shopping too much, owning too much, thinking too much about our very material-filled lives. There's a lot of benefit to scaling back and living simply. We'd be thinking a lot more clearly and thinking about what really matters more if we did. Okay, how about the boastful pride of life? This is craving the adulation of other people. Egotism. I was thinking about just the way I'm wired, and I've got a very deep desire to be adulated, admired. Gary would often, he would even say worshipped, and I guess if I was honest, that was true of me as well. But to be thought well of by people that I respect. Coronated, thank you. Oh, man. When I'm watching a movie and somebody does something great and they get applauded for it, I tear up. And I tear up because I want that so bad. Seriously. And so, we are built not to function that way. Here's the thing. We're creatures. That's the clear teaching of the Bible. We are contingent. We depend on God for everything. When praise comes our way, we're supposed to pass it down the line like a fireman passing a bucket of water, right? No, that's not for me. That goes down the line. But we see that praise and we get enamored and we want to hold on to it. And we forget, no, this is the boastful pride of life. I'm staring into the Palantir, the eye of Saruman here. Yeah, this is what Lewis says. Pride, this type of boastful pride of life, it's a fall. a fall of the creature's attention from what's better, God, to what's worse itself. That's right. We get sucked in all the time. So these are the components of the cosmos. Do these resonate with you? I think if we're honest, we see a lot of this going on all over the place and in our own hearts. All right, so what should we do here? Why should we reject the cosmos? We get three reasons why that are in this passage. First, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Okay, and that's kind of an awkward phrase, love of the Father. It literally means love toward the Father. Your love toward God cannot coexist with loving the world. You can't do both at the same time. I was at a high school Bible study recently, and a kid told me that he was a Michigan fan and an Ohio State fan. I'm like, dude, you are not a fan of either team. You don't get it. Right? And, you know, you realize, you know, our heart can be swept away by these values, these destructive values. And when that happens, we can't enjoy intimacy with God. The Bible has a term for this called spiritual adultery. Our heart is stolen. And James says, you adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world, and this is the word cosmos, and he's using it this way, it's hostility toward God. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. That's pretty stark language. We have to choose. Let's say, there was infidelity in your own marriage. God forbid. You know, what would it take to restore intimacy with your spouse? I mean, there would have to be total commitment to honesty, changing who you hang out with. There'd have to be time spent rediscovering each other, being accountable to people outside the relationship. There would have to be a very decisive choice to move toward your spouse and away from whatever it was you were into. And it's the same thing here. You know, diagnosing this is not too hard if we're just willing to pause and ask ourselves where our head's been at. What do we daydream about? What's your ideal future? Well, what kind of values dictate what that looks like? Who are you emulating? You know, who's the pace setter that you're trying to keep up with? What are you eager to do in your spare time? What are you like, oh, I just can't wait until I fill in the blank? What about when advancing your status and success conflict with loving people? Who wins? Who's going to have to wait? If you have some extra cash, what do you first think of spending it on? Or how about this? What do you want most for your kids? You know, in Philippians 3, Paul says, I count everything as loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Jesus Christ. There's nothing in my life more precious than intimacy with God. Is that your highest aspiration for your children? Yeah, you got to think about these things to really diagnose where your heart's at. And of course, if you find out, like I often have, and we often do, that you've lost it here, how should we respond? Well, one thing you can do is you got to talk it through with God, just like you would with your spouse. You've just got to sit down and go, you know, it's evident that my heart's been far from you. I'm not even concerned about things that you value. I've been completely captivated by these other pursuits. I know you love me. I'm sorry. And I want to restore a closer friendship with you. And you just have to talk it through. I think the other thing that's important is to get somebody else to help you out. It's hard to break free from this tractor beam of these values. You guys have seen this scene, haven't you? This is the Lord of the Rings. Grima Wormtongue is on the left. He's a wicked counselor, whispering into the ear of King Theoden on the right. And Grima Wormtongue is lying to him and using these enchantments from an evil wizard called Saruman, trying to basically keep King Theoden weak physically and spiritually and mentally, everything. And you know, a lot of us can be like a Theoden. You know, the dust has settled deeply and we're really, really sunk in and entrenched in these values. We might be financially entrenched, schedule entrenched, just buried in these values. And we need to get around people that know their word, that can speak truth to us, to speak healing words, to help us re-remember what matters and what a precious thing it is to be close to God. If you feel like I'm drowning in this, find somebody that can pull you out. That was a real powerful scene in this movie when Gandalf came in, right, and delivered Theoden. An outsider had to come in and oppose the lies of Grima Wormtongue just to set Theoden free. And sometimes we need that. All right, another reason to reject the cosmos. It's passing away. It's passing away. You can't pursue the world's values. You can't make those things what guides your life and expect to hold on to your gains forever. No way. They're not going to make it past the grave. That's obvious. They're not even going to make it halfway through your life. I mean, think about how temporal and passing these values are. Here's Arnold Schwarzenegger. He used to look like that. Now he looks like that. The grass withers, according to the Bible, right? The flower fades. The new car smell wears off. Things lose their polish. You guys know who this is? Just without saying it, how many of you actually know who this is? Okay. Five people. For the rest of you, he's a football player. He won a Heisman Trophy. He went first round draft in the NFL. He won with his team four NFL championships, and he won the first Super Bowl. He was in both the college and NFL Hall of Fame. And who is he? Most of us have no idea, but it's Paul Hornung. Yeah. You know, the world's passing away. Another 10 years, nobody here is going to know who this guy is. That's the way it is with fame. That's the way it is with all of this stuff. It's bankrupt. It's empty. What should we respond to with this? Well, let's just ask ourselves, come on. Come on. Don't you want your life to be about something that lasts? Something that has, you know, a solid, enduring, meaningful purpose? Well, if you want that, you've got to free up time for people, because the only eternal thing you are ever going to run into in this life is another human being. That's it. You are sitting next to treasures with so much potential whose lives and actions will go on and impact eternity. And if there's no room in your life for that, come on. Talk about crazy talk. That's crazy talk. 1 Thessalonians 2 says, Paul says, "Who's our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Isn't it even you in the presence of our Lord Jesus that is coming?" You, these people in this church that we've invested in, you're our glory and joy. Yeah, this is crucial. If we're looking at the way we live our lives and we don't have any mental CPU time devoted to people and meeting their needs and addressing them, that ought to be a red light on the dashboard signaling we've been suckered into the values of the world system. Another last thing, and this is the flip side of what we talked about just a second ago. Why should we reject the cosmos? Because when we reject it and focus on the things of God, he says the one who does the will of God lives forever. Now, I don't think he's saying if you do God's will, you get to go to heaven. I don't think that's it. He said in 1 John 2:2, if anyone sins, he has an advocate with the Father. We don't get into heaven by doing God's will, but I think he does mean a life lived in obedience to God's will carry forward into eternity, because what we invest in lasts. So what about that? If that's really the way it is, if that's the nature of reality, how should we respond to this truth? Well, I think we got to serve people. We got to pray to God, give me the strength and even the inclination to do this. Help me do this in your power. But my God, we have to do this. Because it's as you step out and serve people that you start to feel the grip of these values loosen. I mean, just think about your own story. Have you ever remembered a time where you kind of felt moved by God to try to help somebody and you could see the impact that you were having on them, and there was just that sense of, this is rich, being used by God. And then all of a sudden, those values that used to be so captivating just don't seem all that great anymore. Maybe you've been on a short-term missions trip. This is where it really comes out. You're away for 2 weeks, maybe away from where your language is spoken, so you're not bombarded by the world's values. And you're in there, and it's 2 weeks of solid, other-centered service. You ever been on a trip like that? What's it like to come back home the next week or two? It's hard to look at everything the same way, isn't it? Because you've had a taste of a richer life, a clearer, thinner, purer air, a taste of sanity, of what really matters. But then as the months and years go on, the dust starts to settle again, and we drift right back toward that self-serving perspective. But service is what, this is a lifestyle we need to stay sane, to avoid these values. So what have you sensed God nudging you to do lately? This isn't just something God wants you to do. This is an invitation to thinking clearly, you know, to a rich life. Go for it. What needs are you aware of? Just, you know, going into a group and just saying, I'm going to listen. I'm going to really think about what I hear. If I see a need, I'm going to respond to it. That's crucial. As you follow that information and you start to build into people, again, it's rewarding. What about this? Has someone challenged your values recently? Someone tried to rattle you like Gandalf with Theoden and urged you to consider serving? Maybe you thought that was irritating. Or maybe God was using that person to try to wake you up and snap you out of the stupor you're in. What have you read lately in the Bible or heard in a teaching that you could share with someone else? You know, a good number of us were at the Summer Institute for 3 days, our annual conference on things to come. How many good little nuggets did we get out of that? And it's so thrilling to get insights that are helpful. Find someone to share them with. Tell someone what you picked up out of that conference. But this is these things where we're asking God for the strength to move us to do these things. This is the landscape where we can think clearly. All right, so just one last thought before I quit. I realize if you're here and you're not really familiar with Christianity, somehow you wound up here. I don't know how. When I talk to folks that are, you know, not religious or whatever, a lot of times this is what they say: I'm just too busy to think about God. I think a lot of Americans feel this way. Job, kids, soccer. When am I going to find time to think about God? And let me just suggest that sense that I'm too busy to get around to this is not by accident. It's not a coincidence. This is by design. This is the whole purpose of the world's values, is to keep you from slowing down and really thinking about the offer God has on the table. And so I've got you here for a little bit. And I just want to make sure nobody walks out of this room having missed the message that Satan wants to conceal. So here it is. This is one of many verses that talk about this. By grace, it says, you've been saved through faith. This is saying that we can have right standing with God, be forgiven by God through faith. Notice he says, it's not of yourselves, it's a gift. Not as a result of works, that nobody should boast. You aren't going to earn your way into heaven. You're not going to impress God with your good life. Everyone's screwed up. That's what the Bible says. It's by faith, not by good works. And isn't it shocking? Like, isn't it commonly thought that the way to get into heaven is by being a good person? Haven't you heard that? That is the number one way people think about it. And it's dead wrong. Well, why is that? How could something so clear be so distorted? Satan is in the world. blinding the minds of the unbelieving. That's why. And so there you go. This is the offer. You can know God right now and be forgiven by Him if you turn to Him in faith and depend on Him to forgive you and receive Him into your life. That's the teaching. That's the emphasis of the Bible. That's the message God has for you. It says in 1 John, who overcomes the cosmos? Who breaks into the clear and gets it? It's the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. You're going to, after this, you're going to get in the car and drive home. You're going to turn on the radio or, you know, try to clean up a mess with the kids in the back. So I don't know what's going to happen to you. But you're not going to be thinking about this all day long. And you may not get back to this for a very long time. And I would just urge you to not set this issue aside, to look into the claims of Christ, to consider this offer. If you feel like you're already persuaded and you haven't done this yet, this is the time. Do it while you're thinking straight. And if you're still not persuaded, what could be more important than, you know, setting down the shampoo bottle and turning off the TV or whatever it is that you're distracted by and really burrowing into, well, what does the Bible say about who God is and how I can know Him? That's time well spent. So, God, thanks for the tender heart of concern you have for us, how you showed that by giving your own Son to die for us. I thank you that your values are enduring. They make sense. They heal families, strengthen relationships, and they'll ring into eternity. And I just pray we wouldn't miss out on the opportunity we each have with your strength to really touch a lot of lives and to enjoy the impact of that forever. Just help us think clearly about this and quickly return to you when we realize that we've lost our way. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.